Good morning. How's everyone doing? Thanks for coming out on this beautiful fall day. It seems like fall is here early this year, which is fine with me. Before I start talking, let's sit quietly for 2 or 3 minutes together. So if you're sitting in a chair, please put your stuff down, put your feet flat on the floor, and sit straight, shoulders back. If you're on a cushion, sit nice and straight, shoulders back, head not inclining either to the right or the left. And take a nice deep breath to start. And before we begin, let's just cultivate a bit a feeling of gratitude. It's always good to start a meditation with a feeling of gratitude. Gratitude that we're able to be here together this morning. Gratitude for this opportunity to share in something, to share in the Dharma. Gratitude for this beautiful day. And now let's turn our attention to our breath. And simply focus on the experience of breathing without bringing thought to it. Okay, thank you. So this morning, I'm talking about Amban's 49th case. And if you have a program, the case is on your program there. It says, the case, the sutra says, stop, stop, don't try to expound it. The Dharma mysteriously transcends thinking. So this is a case. It could also be called a koan, and many of you know koans well and have worked with koans. But in case you're really new, I'll just tell you briefly that a koan is something that is used in Zen practice. Sometimes a teacher will assign a koan to a student and expect a response. We don't do that so much here. We tend to use them for teaching. We talk about them. And they are meant to be elicit a response, but they cannot be solved logically. You cannot bring your conventional ways of thinking to a koan and resolve it. And in fact, I think koans are designed to bring you to a place of discomfort, a place where you get a little frustrated because your ordinary ways of thinking are not working. They bring you to that place, and that is fertile ground for something to happen, which is going to shake you out of your ordinary ways of thinking. So this is called Amban's 49th case, and this appears in a collection called The Gateless Gate, which many of you are familiar with. And it is interesting because The Gateless Gate was written by a person named Muman in China during the Song Dynasty. This was published in the year 1229. It was written by Muman, and there are 48 cases in here. But this 49th case was written by someone else, someone named Amban. and he added it 17 years after it was published in the year 1246, which is pretty audacious, I think. We have Mumon writing these 48 koans and collecting them, and this guy comes in and he adds another one. He's going to kind of sum it all up. He's going to get the last word here. Pretty audacious. And Amban, all I know about him is that he was a civil official and literary man. So he was a layperson. He was not a priest, which makes this even a little more audacious. But of course, you don't have to be a priest to deeply penetrate the Dharma, so I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek. So this is the 49th case, and actually there are two 49th cases. Another guy wrote a 49th case. They didn't know about each other, but we don't need to go into that. So Amban starts, so there's the case you have in your program, but there's more. There's kind of introduction, there's the case, there's the comment, and then there's a verse. So there's quite a lot of stuff for me to go through here, and I'll go through it very slowly. So he starts out, Old Master Mumon drafted 48 cases and judged the koans of ancient teachers. Old Master Mumon drafted 48 cases and judged the koans of ancient teachers. This is interesting. He calls him Old Master Mumon. So he is, I think, showing him a lot of respect. He's calling him an old master. And we do that a lot in our Zen tradition. We have this lineage of ancestors going all the way back to the Buddha, and actually before the Buddha, to other Buddhas, and we revere these figures, these old masters, the Buddhas and ancestors. So it seems like he's giving him his due by calling him old master. And then he says he judged the koans of ancient teachers, so a little respect for ancient teachers here. But there's one word in this translation that gives me pause, and that is judged. And judged is the word used here in Sakita's translation, and Yamada also uses that word, judged. So he's judging the koans of the ancient masters. And judge is a word I use a lot when I'm trying to explain Zen. And I use it in a way that I'm kind of saying, don't do it, don't judge. Because I like to talk about judging as a form of putting a sort of overlay, a logical overlay on this world. This world is a bright and vivid place. It is what it is. We could call it this world. We could call it that which is. It is a thing. It is something, or maybe it's nothing, that can be directly experienced by us. We can directly experience it in sort of all of its glory without any intervening words or thoughts or anything like that. But we tend to use words and thoughts. We tend to add a thought overlay to everything. We give names to things, and that's very helpful to us because we can then talk about them. We look for patterns in things. We look for patterns in things, and we try to see how things form a pattern, so we think, okay, next time I see that pattern, I'm going to know what to do. I'm going to learn something from that. We learn these patterns. We get in trouble when we start mistaking the pattern we see, the pattern we identify with our thinking, our logical mind, and we think that's reality. We think that's reality. The pattern is reality. The pattern we see is not reality. Reality is underneath the pattern. I was driving to Zen Center this morning, and I was on I-94 coming from St. Paul to Minneapolis, and I came to this place. It was near an overpass, and one thing I love about fall is the birds start kind of coming together, you know, and there was this big flock of sparrows, and just as I came to them with my truck, this flock of sparrows, which was really huge, just, you know, rises up from the median, and it's right there, and it was so close, I thought, wow, I might hit these sparrows with my truck. But of course I didn't, and this whole huge flock of sparrows sort of changed shape to avoid my truck, you know, so I missed them. They veered away, you know. And so this flock, it's like this flock has a life of its own, you know. And we want to name things in the world, and we want to consider them as individual things. So we think a bird. A bird is a thing, right? You can't argue that an individual bird is a thing. So we say bird. But then we look at the flock and we see how it has a life of its own. Which is the thing? Is it the bird or is it the flock? And in the same way, you can look at the human body. You know, which is the thing here? Is it this body? This body that I call Ted, is that the thing? Or is maybe each individual cell the thing? I mean, the same way that the birds, the individual cells are like the individual birds. And this thing we call Ted is just this sort of collection of little things. Which is the actual thing? Or is the actual thing the components of the cells, which are even, you know, tinier? Which is it? We've got all these layers of things. And we pick out one thing, we give it a name, and we say, that's reality, you know. But it's all just conventions. It's all just words we give to it. There's this interrelated thing underneath all of that. Underneath all of that talking and thinking and judging. And judging I think of as, we tend to judge the world in terms of what's good, what's bad, what's neutral. If it's good, we like it. If it's bad, we don't like it, etc. We're constantly judging. So when Amban says, old master Mumon drafted 48 cases and judged the koans of ancient teachers, in using that word judging, is he maybe tweaking Mumon a little bit and saying, Mumon, I think you're judging these koans. I think you're telling us whether you like them or not. I think you're adding some kind of thought overlay to these koans. Well, maybe, and actually I think he is, because wait till you hear this next sentence. He says that Mumon, he, is like a fried bean cake seller who wants to open the customer's mouth and stuff it with his cakes until the customer can neither swallow nor disgorge them. What? What? So, Mumon is like a fried bean cake seller. I think that's a fried tofu seller, probably. He's like a tofu seller. You go to the tofu seller, you give him your money, and instead of giving you a nice plate of tofu, he stuffs your mouth full of tofu to the point where you can't swallow and you can't spit it out. That's how full your mouth is. Wow, what a thing to say about old Master Mumon. And I think, you know, he's talking about how Mumon has filled our minds, right, with all of these words. Mumon has filled our minds with so many words that we're just full. We don't know what to do with these. So, and I can think of three possibilities for why he would be saying such a thing about Mumon, that Mumon is stuffing us full in this way. And the first way is that it's just too many words. That Mumon is just giving us too many words. Never mind that each of these koans is about breaking through words. Each of these koans is about forgetting that overlay of logic and just looking at the thing. That's what every one of these koans is trying to do. Every one of these koans is trying to shake us out of that and say, no, it's not that. It's not what you think. It's something else. It's just this. It's what's right here. Never mind that still. Something about the cumulative effect of these 48 koans is just stuffing our brains full to the point where we don't know what to do. We're just getting all of this stuff. We're getting all of these words, all of these cases. Each case, there's the case itself, there's a comment, there's a verse, there are notes that are added later. This is an awful lot of stuff. Or at least we may take it that way. You know, all of these koans are designed to shake us out of our conventional way of thinking so we don't make things into a thing. And we can, but here's what we might do. We might look at these 48 cases and say, okay, I'm going to read all of these 48 cases. I'm going to read every comment, every verse. I'm going to read every note. I'm going to think about every one. I'm going to come up with a response. I'm going to go to my teacher. I'm going to work through these 48 cases, and I'm going to progress on the road to enlightenment. Well, what have we done? We've made this into a thing, right? We've made this pattern. We've put this logical overlay over everything. Maybe Mumon is not creating patterns. Maybe Mumon is trying to help us break through the patterns. But we could make something out of that ourselves and turn this into this great big thing, which is just one more obstacle to our practice. So that's one possibility about why he would compare Mu Man to a fried bean cake seller who stuffs your mouth full. And I think another possibility, maybe a remote possibility, but he could be saying something about how in Zen we tend to set up this sacred and non-sacred dichotomy, which can be not helpful. We identify certain things as sacred. We don't use that word sacred, but our actions can sometimes result in what seems to be that. He could be saying that Mu Man, by finding these 48 cases from these old masters and publishing them as one book and kind of enshrining their words and putting their words up on a shelf, is being sort of overly formal and saying, these 48 cases, here is the answer. It's up here on the shelf. That's what we look at. Forget the rest of the world down here. He could be saying that. And this kind of thing happens in Zen, I think. We tend to make these distinctions. You'll notice sometimes when people enter the Zendo, they will bow. And in the mornings when we're formal, everyone bows when they enter the Zendo. And that's an interesting thing to do. I think we bow when we enter the Zendo for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons we bow when we enter the Zendo is as kind of a reminder that this is a special place. This is the Zendo. This is a place where I really want to be at my best, because I have come here with a number of other people, and we have come here for a very serious purpose. We are dealing with the great questions of life, the great questions of life and death. How should one live a human life? We are all here to support each other in that. We're going to make a great effort here sitting. This is a very special place. So we're bowing. And we have Manjushri up here on the altar. And we treat the altar as like it's a sacred space, you know. We go up to the altar and we bow. We don't set our coffee or our water on the altar because it's a really special place. But also, at the same time, we know that in a way the Zendo is not a special place, that the whole world is our Zendo, that we are setting the Zendo apart as a special place where we can be at our best, because that's going to help us with our practice. This is a place where we come and we quiet things down and conditions are right, and we can really make this special effort here. But we also know that the whole world is interrelated, and it's not like some parts are the sacred parts set off and the other parts are the defiled parts that we don't want to be in. And it's like we have to make the sacred Zendo part bigger so it sort of displaces all of the unsacred part out there. No, that's not it. It's all the same. It's really all the same stuff. And what we ultimately have to learn to do is to function out in the world the same way we function here in the Zendo. We set this apart because that helps us, but ultimately there's no distinction between sacred and non-sacred, you know. And we have an altar with Manjushri on it, but it's just an altar. It's just something we do to help us. And the only way this traditional stuff is going to work, the only way that it can possibly work for us to do these formal things that look so much like a religion, bowing and things like that, the only way that can work is if we understand at the same time that it's just a convention. It's something we have chosen to do. It's something that helps us. But everything is interrelated. No sacred, no profane. So he could be pointing this out. And some folks think, by the way, that the best way to deal with this is to kind of get rid of all the sacred-looking stuff so people don't get confused. I happen to think that keeping the sacred stuff and knowing just what it is very is the most helpful thing. But that's just me. So he could be comparing Mu Man to a fried bean cake seller because it's just too many words, because the words are too sacred. And there's a third possible reason, which is, I think, much more positive. Perhaps he is looking at this as a positive thing, stuffing someone's mouth full of rice cakes. And when I read that line, I was reminded of something that happens to me sometimes during retreat. And actually, how retreats are for me has changed quite a bit over the years. But I have had retreats where this certain pattern was followed. And it seemed to be followed a lot. I could almost predict it. I would be on, say, a 3 or 4 or 5 day retreat. And in the beginning, I would be very sort of rested and ready to go. And I would be making a great effort. And my mind would get very quiet. And the whole first day would be wonderful like that. The second day, I would begin to get very tired because retreats are hard. And about the middle of the afternoon of the second day, I am so tired that I collapse a little bit. I'm giving up a little bit. And all these thoughts come rushing in. All these thoughts come rushing in. The 10,000 things, I think of them as. That's a Buddhist expression, the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things come rushing in. Just every kind of thought, and it's so distressing. Who knows, old TV shows are in there, and songs are in there, and all of my worries, and all of my troubles, and all of my speculation, and even judging, maybe even judging the people that are at the retreat with me, which is pretty sad. But these things happen. The 10,000 things come rushing in. And that is not a good place to be. It almost sometimes makes me physically ill to have these 10,000 things rushing in. And it is really hard. But something happens. You can't stay there forever. And if you stay with the retreat and you stay with where you are, something happens, and eventually that cacophony of stuff, something happens and it just goes away, or it lifts and there's something quieter underneath. And you're no longer captive of the 10,000 things. And it may happen for just a little bit, and you may get a glimpse of it, or it may happen in a really big way that it's just sort of gone. Like, wow, I can't believe it. It's like every thought in the universe rushed in and took over my entire being, and somehow I lifted, and I now realize I am not the sum total of my thoughts. There is something else here. There is something quiet. So being in that place where you've got all of this stuff in your mind can be a really fertile place that leads to something else, that leads to a kind of lifting. So perhaps he's saying that Mumon, by giving us 48 unsolvable questions, is really helping us. He's kind of stuffing our brain full of contradictions to bring us to this place of discomfort where some kind of resolution will occur. Perhaps he's saying that. And then Amban goes on and he says, be that as it may, whichever of Ted's three theories are correct, be that as it may, now Amban wants to cook an extra one on Mumon's hot oven and add it to the 48 and offer it to you in Mumon's manner. So be that as it may, he's going to give us another one. I wonder where the master would put his teeth into it. I wonder what Mumon would think about this. If anyone can swallow it at once, he will emit the Buddha light, and make the earth shake. If he cannot, the present 48 plus this one will turn into the red hot sands of hell. If anyone can swallow it at once, he will emit the Buddha light and make the earth shake. I think by swallowing it at once, I think he's talking about the kind of transformation I was talking about when, during retreat, the cacophony of noises lifts and something much quieter is underneath. That is, I don't really like the word transcend, but it's kind of transcending the 10,000 things. It's swallowing it all at once. Your mouth is so full, you just can't move. You've got the 10,000 things, and you think there's no way out, and yet somehow you are able to swallow this unswallowable thing because something has happened, something out of the realm of the ordinary, something that has nothing to do with our ordinary logical way. And so you emit the Buddha light, and you make the earth shake. If you can't do that, the present 48 plus this one will turn into the red hot sands of hell. So, yeah, being stuck there is not a good thing. Being stuck in the 10,000 things. In a way, a lot of us are stuck in the 10,000 things a lot of the time, and it is kind of hellish in a way. You know, it's under there sometimes. Sometimes we feel it more acutely. We don't want to be stuck there. And then, these are my two favorite lines of this 49th case. He says, "Say quickly, say quickly." And I like that because he's saying, well, what does he want us to say quickly? I guess he wants us to resolve this. I guess he wants us to resolve this problem. What's the deal here with having your mouth stuffed in this way, and what can you do about it? He says, say quickly, because don't think about it. You cannot think about it. You've got to do it right now. You've got to deal with this right now, and you've got to come out with something. It has to be instantaneous. It can't be based on thought. There is no time for deliberation. It can only be now. And I think what he's saying, it can only be now, it can only be now, means fully being in that place with your mouth stuffed so full you can neither swallow it nor spit it out. It's like just fully accepting that situation and seeing where that goes. And if we want to talk about analogously what it's like when our mind is full, it's fully accepting the fullness of that mind and our situation here on this planet of being awake, our situation of being in this room, fully accepting that and fully being there on that edge of discomfort. To be there in that place with your mouth full. And so then we come to the case which is on your program. The sutra says, stop, stop. Don't try to expound it. The Dharma mysteriously transcends thinking. So what does Amban say as he audaciously chooses to cap off Mumon's 48 cases? The 48 cases have all of these stories about the ancestors. The 48 cases have stories about the Buddha. The 48 cases kind of incorporate 1,700 years of Buddhism at that point. All of these stories, all of this wisdom wrapped up together. And he has the audacity to add something to that. And what does he say about this huge body of knowledge? He says, stop. Stop. He says it twice. He just says, stop. Just stop. And what does that mean? Stop. Here I go, I'm about to explain it. After he just said, stop. Ted, stop. Stop talk. There's a spider right there. Just stop, okay? And let's think about this spider. Do you see him? Here he comes. He's heading for me. Just stop all the thinking, you know? Don't go down to the library and read those 2,000 books down there. Don't listen to the 3,000 Dharma talks that we have online or however many there are. Oh, thanks for being gentle with the spider. Just stop. Stop all the thinking and trying because it's got to be here. That's got to be what it is. It's got to be just here, right now, on this edge of discomfort. This edge of whatever is going on right now, that's what it's got to be. It can never be anything else. I'm sorry, but this is it. This is it right now. This is what it's always going to be. You got to be here. You got to come to this. You just got to come to this. And there he goes. Stop, stop. Don't try to expound it. The Dharma mysteriously transcends thinking. So stay on this edge of discomfort. Okay. Then we get to Amban's comment. And he says, this kills me. He says, where does the Dharma come from? And I think this is just ridiculous. I think this is so funny. I've spent a lot of time with this. He says, where does the Dharma come from? after telling us that we should stop and just end all of this thinking and end trying to use Zen as a pattern to further interpret the world, he says, where does the Dharma come from? Can you imagine a more useless question? Where does the Dharma come from? How could the Dharma come from someplace? What kind of question is this? This is like opening us to idle speculation. Oh, let's all think about where the Dharma comes from. That's so useless. What if you were to ask the Buddha, where does the Dharma come from? What would he say? He would say, don't ask that. You don't need to know that. That's ridiculous. And the Buddha would tell you the parable of the arrow. You know, a guy gets shot with an arrow, and he calls the doctor, and the doctor comes in, and what kind of questions is he going to ask the guy? He's not going to ask him, who shot the arrow? How was he dressed? What was his name? What was he thinking about? How long was his bow? The guy's dying. The guy needs help, right? And we're like that. The Buddha devoted himself to ending suffering, and we're here suffering, and are we going to speculate about who shot the arrow or where the Dharma came from, or are we going to do something about who shot the arrow, and are we going to do something about ending suffering? So he says, where does the Dharma come from? And I think he's just being ridiculous here, and I could almost imagine him saying it in some kind of a mocking tone. Where does the Dharma come from? How could it be mysterious? What about when it is expounded? So I think he's bringing us right back in the soup, right? Right after saying, stop, stop, he comes up with this kind of ridiculous question to kind of show us how we're back in, how easy it is to slip back into thinking. And then he says, not only Bukan was talkative, Shakyamuni himself was the original chatterbox. Okay, whoa. So, for one thing, you have to counteract the sacred a little bit, right? And of course, we have that saying, if you see the Buddha coming down the road, kill him. So, Bukan, he refers to Bukan. One of the notes says, when Master Bukan was abbot at Kokuseiji Temple in Mount Tendai, Kanzan and Jitoku visited him in the kitchen. Okay, so two monks are visiting the abbot at this temple. And Bukan greeted the two, saying, here come Bodhisattvas Manjushri and Samantabhadra. Upon this, the two named him Bukan the Chatterbox. So these two monks come in, and he says, oh, look, you guys, you're like these two great Bodhisattvas, Manjushri and Samantabhadra. Well, not a very helpful comment at the monastery, I think, to praise them in that way. It's just going to kind of get their minds going, thinking about how cool they are, and getting them away from the moment. It's really the kind of idle chatter that does not help with one's practice at all. And there's a place for idle chatter, and it's fun, but, you know, sometimes it's just not the right thing. So they named him a chatterbox. And then he says that Shakyamuni, the Buddha, himself was the original chatterbox. And he goes on to say, that old fellow created a lot of phantoms and made 1,000 generations tumble about in entanglements, unable to stick their heads out. That old fellow, the Buddha, created a lot of phantoms and made 1,000 generations tumble about in entanglements. Another translation says, entangled in vines. So he just basically tangled everybody up in vines. The Buddha himself did. The Buddha, by emitting all of those words over his lifetime, and there are, you know, thick volumes of the Buddha's words, as remembered by Ananda, that this just tied people up. Now, of course, the Buddha did say these words for helpful reasons, and they are very helpful. But if you're not careful, it is going to tie you up. If you look at the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, and you say, I'm going to read them all, I'm going to study every word, and you get a little attached to the words and the page, at the expense of understanding the actual reality, direct reality that it's pointing to, you're going to be in trouble there. Okay, and now Amban goes on to say, as for the present fine cases of Mumon, you cannot scoop them up or steam them. Okay, Amban, at this point, you're just making my brain tired. Because you're bringing back your metaphor about cooking the rice cakes, and you're talking about scooping them up or steaming them, and do I now have to try to figure out what is going on there and what it means? And I can look at this other translation, and it says, such amazing talks as these cases cannot be spooned up or cooked enough, though we steam them in a boiling pot. I don't really know what he's talking about. I don't want to have to try to figure it out. I think he might be talking about how you can't solve this stuff logically again. And then he says, some puzzled people may ask, after all, what is the conclusion of all of this? So after telling us to stop, he's bringing in more stuff. He's bringing in these questions. Well, what does it all mean? What does it all mean? It doesn't mean anything. Stop. He's bringing this back again. And then Amban puts his 10 fingernails together and says, stop, don't try to expound it. The Dharma mysteriously transcends thinking. And a note here says that Amban, by putting his 10 fingernails together, that what he's doing here is he's gashoing like we do when we recite. So he's simply reciting the case. He is not adding to it. Some onlooker has asked, what's the meaning of all this? Amban simply puts his fingers together and he recites the sutra and says, stop. So he's bringing us back to this simplicity. And in a flash, he draws a small circle over the two words, transcends thinking, and shows it, saying, the 5,000 volumes of the Sutra and Vimalakirti's one gate only are all here. So by drawing a little circle, he is bringing attention to those two words, transcends thinking. And he says, the 5,000 volumes of the sutras are right here. Transcends thinking. That's all you need. You don't need the sutras. And Vimalakirti's one gate only is here. And Vimalakirti was a lay person who followed the path of the Bodhisattva in the world. And there's this story about one day Vimalakirti asked Manjushri up here, what does it mean that the Bodhisattva enters the Dharma gate of not two? And Manjushri said, I see it like this. In all phenomena, there are neither words nor explanations, neither presentations nor knowledge. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is what I understand of to enter the Dharma gate of not two. Same thing that Amban's been talking about the whole time. No words, no explanations. So, and there's one last part, which is Amban's verse, and that is four lines. If anyone tells you light is fire, move your head and make no answer. One devil knows the way of another. At one question, all is clear. If anyone tells you light is fire, move your head and make no answer. One devil knows the way of another. At one question, all is clear. So if anyone tells you light is fire, I think what he's talking about here is expounding the Dharma. Light is fire. We perceive light and fire as being two separate things. Ordinarily, we perceive them that way. But if we deeply understand interdependence, we know that light is fire, that they are the same. We know they are also different. If someone comes to us and they're saying these two things are the same and also different, that is expounding the Dharma. That is using words. Light is fire. Expounding the Dharma. If anyone tells you light is fire, if anyone expounds the Dharma to you, move your head and make no answer. Move your head and make no answer. So we know You just stop, right? You're just supposed to stop. So someone expounds the Dharma to you, Mumon or the ancestors or Shakyamuni or anybody, they expound this to you, move your head and make no answer. So maybe moving your head is kind of acknowledging, okay, I hear this, but you make no answer. Making no answer is perfect because you're not using a concept. You're not using a word. And move your head is good too. I like move your head because move your head is an action. Move your head, however you do it, is an action here in this world. And I think it's in action that we see both that light is fire and that light is not fire. That we see that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. It's in action that these two seemingly irreconcilable points of view can come together. In action, such as a bow, we are bowing here in the practical world. I'm bowing to the person in front of me, treating that person as a separate person. We're doing something practical and beautiful here in the world. But at the same time, when I bow in this way, I'm aware of all the interdependence of the world. I know I'm really not separate from this person. And it is in action that all of this is reconciled, that all of this can just be. The simple action of the Zendo and our simple actions out there in the world. If anyone tells you light is fire, move your head and make no answer. One devil knows the way of another. One devil knows the way of another. And I think the other translation says, a thief knows a thief. And when I read this, I think about, okay, here we have two monks, maybe, or two experienced people who know about the Dharma. And the one expounds the Dharma, and the other says nothing and simply moves his head. These are two very different ways of dealing with the Dharma. Some folks think that it's really good to expound the Dharma and explain the Dharma. And I'm on that end of the continuum. I'll use any kind of words, any kind of example, any kind of self-revelation if I think it's going to help someone to understand what all of this is pointing to. And I could be accused of talking too much. Just like Mooma and Shakyamuni could be accused of talking too much. I think those explanations are helpful. On the other end of the continuum, you have teachers who sort of don't come down to the level of the practical, logical mind to explain things. They stay up there and they kind of demonstrate what's going on by speaking from the point of view of interdependence. And Katagiri, I think, was really like that. And we have folks who would never expound the Dharma at all, who are never going to tell you what the Dharma means, but if you watch them and you see what they're doing, you see them working out in the yard, you see the way they move those wood chips around, or you see the way they're sweeping the floor, or the way they're just here in the Zendo doing their sitting, no big deal, you realize there's a profound teaching in that. And they're not saying anything at all, but they are teaching us in a profound way, and that's really beautiful. And we have a lot of those really quiet people like that around here. You have to watch pretty closely to see what they're doing, to identify them, because they do it in such an ordinary way, and they want to be ordinary. It's just ordinary. But these two know each other. These two know each other. The one who talks a lot and the one who doesn't talk at all. They see each other. These are both valid ways of doing it. And finally, the last line. At one question, all is clear. At one question, all is clear. Not at one answer. There is no answer here. There is no answer to be found. There is no answer to be looked for. There's only the continual question. And this is pointing us, I think, toward how to practice. It's to continually ask that question, to continually remain in that place of discomfort, to continually be there thinking, my mouth is totally stuffed full. What is this like? And investigating that and not looking for the next thing and not trying to do something and not seeking something. At one question, all is clear, because it's just a question. As I said before, it's just this. It's just this. And it's a big question, because we can never know it. We can never see it. We can never categorize it or analyze it. It's just this coming. It's just this coming. And what is it? Okay, it was that. It's always that. Just this coming. And I can imagine Amban just saying, please, please just keep asking this question. Just stay with the question and just stay in the place. And that's what Mooman was pointing to, and that's what Shakyamuni Buddha was pointing to, and that's what this whole practice is pointing to. It's just this. That's what it's got to be. Stop. So, thank you. Thank you. Would anyone like to say something? Or ask a question? Yes, Gary.
Try this on maybe. When you said it, just say it hard.
Yeah, say quickly.
Say quickly. Right. Say it before you fit hold. As you think, or before you think, or whatever have you, but just spontaneously, I think it's meaningful. How does having that frustration with myself, which I've had a number of times, is I found myself wanting to say something to somebody, and I kept adding one platform, you know, I better explain what that means, and I better explain what that means, and all of a sudden, you know, I was this huge mountain of words, you know?
Right.
And, you know, all of a sudden I realized, first, I was getting pretty bored, you know. And I just thought, when you said it anyway, I just thought to myself, yes, just, you know, just when you see, clearly see something, just do it. You know, kind of drop, kind of. You don't have to overthink every little thing that comes up.
Right. I think that can be helpful. And I think your intention in explaining things is probably really good, and social interactions are complex, and you want to be very careful you say it in the right way, that's going to be constructive, not hurt someone, it's going to build bridges, etc. But I guess if you get too stuck on that, you end up building this elaborate structure. And if you could just, you know, break through that and say quickly, you know, sometimes that's the most helpful thing to do. So I feel like I just repeated what you said with a lot more words. You said it pretty well, actually.
Yeah, but it was you saying it that kind of triggered.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of a conundrum. On the one hand, it's good to be circumspect and look at something from every possible angle, you know. But you can better understand why other people think I have a completely surprising opinion about something. You know, how did they come to that conclusion? Why do they feel like that? So the circumspect is good, but in speech, you know, you feel like you're on the same page, so to speak, with the person you're talking to. I feel that's right for sure.
Yeah, I think those moments when you really break through with another person or a group of people and you're laughing together or you're all just really struck by something and you just have this really live moment, it tends to be when you do say quickly, right in that moment you kind of realize it and you say it at the same time, you know. And those are really live moments, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Last I saw it was under, what's your name again?
Gabriel.
Last I saw it was headed under here. But then I saw another one over by Paul. And, okay. Thank you, spiders. Thank you so much.
They help us live in the moment.
They do. Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we turn this over to Paul for some announcements?